From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. There's a revolution in communication going on, fueled by digital technology. Old media is fading. Cell phones are becoming the new computers. So where is it all going from here? Joining us to peek over the horizon are two big thinkers on these issues. Ed Lazauska, computer science and engineering professor at the University of Washington, and University of Washington computer science professor Oren Etzioni. He's the founder of Faircast, which has become Bing Travel. That's the website that predicts where airfares are going to be going in the future. And I wanted you both to come in because I know you think about this broadly and have a lot of insight into both the technology and its impact on human beings. Ed, when we asked you to talk about this, one of the first things you mentioned was cloud computing, taking really the computer functions off of your personal computer and putting them on servers connected to the internet. Why do you think is that a significant thing we'll be seeing more of? What's it going to mean for us?
Well, let's think about what it means and where it's headed. Werner Vogels, who's the CTO of Amazon.com, has this great slide he uses in presentations, and it's a photo of the tasting room of a beer brewery in Belgium, a brewery that's been around for a couple of hundred years. And the tasting room is the room where they used to generate their own electricity. And the thing that you can set your glasses of beer on is this enormous brass apparatus that used to generate the power. And Werner's story basically is 10 years from now, if you're running your own data center, it's going to be about as smart as generating your own electricity. We don't do that. And I think that's really true. So cloud computing has a lot of aspects, many of the people are totally comfortable with. You're comfortable with your email being in the cloud. You don't run your own mail server. I don't run my own mail server. You use Hotmail or Gmail or something like that. You have probably an iPod, which is connected to the cloud. That's how you get your music. I have a Kindle, which is connected to the cloud. That's how I get my books. That's how I get my newspapers and things like that. So, you know, there are applications, documents. There are companies that you would think own computers, but don't. They just do it all in the cloud.
Oren, do you agree? Do you think that the cloud getting stuff off our actual devices is what we'll be seeing more of going forward?
Yes, I do agree. And I think that the point that Ed made is really worth emphasizing, right? There are more mobile phones both here and, of course, in other countries, then there are desktop computers. More and more of our computing is happening in those devices, and that's really enabled by the cloud.
You mentioned the Kindle, and people who are using Amazon's electric book, the Kindle, to read George Orwell's 1984 recently were surprised to see it vanish. Amazon discovered there was some copyright issues, so they pulled the ebook off all the users' devices with no advance warning. Amazon's Jeff Bezos apologized by saying it was stupid, thoughtless, and out of line with the company's principles. But the matter is not settled for Mr. Justin Garansky, a 17-year-old student in Michigan. He happened to be reading 1984 on his Kindle, and he was taking electronic notes on the device for a school assignment. And when Amazon pulled the plug on his machine, the notes remained. But Garansky says they're useless because they're no longer linked to the text. So he's suing the company.
This is an important case, an important precedent to set, so that in the future we do own our digital copies of things.
Has this experience changed the way that you do your work on the Kindle?
I mean, I certainly am. I don't feel comfortable purchasing a book on a Kindle anymore, considering I don't feel like I own it. And until this issue is dealt with by Amazon because of this lawsuit, then I don't think that I could ever use it as seriously as I was before.
Why have you gone to the expense and the time of hiring an attorney to take this to court?
You know, like I said before, I just want to help mature the ebook industry and help move forward and help set a precedent so that something like this doesn't happen again.
Isn't it going to cost you a lot of money to make your point, though, by hiring an attorney?
That's attorney privilege information.
That's high school senior Justin Garansky in Michigan. He's suing Amazon because 1984 was taken off his ebook along with all his notes for that. He said, I distrust it, and I'm wondering whether either of you think that this particular event or future things that haven't happened yet are going to make people not want to have all that stuff up in the cloud where someone else has control over it. What do you think?
You know, my feeling is that there are pros and cons to every new technology and every new use of technology, and we often work these things out over time. Amazon was in a bind here, right? There was a copyright violation. They had to figure out how to deal with it. Jeff Bezos has admitted that they chose a less than optimal way to deal with it. But my view is these things happen and they will get worked out. I've been away on a trip for the past 2 weeks, and 2 days ago, the disk on my laptop died. taking south with it about 12 days of work. Let me tell you, I wish all of that had been in the cloud because I wouldn't have lost 12 days of work.
We're talking about the horizons of technology. We're at 206-543-5869. Maybe you have a question for our guest, Ed Lazauska, who you just heard from, and also Oren Etzioni. Both of them are at the University of Washington, and they are focusing on this stuff all the time. Oren, tell us a little bit about where you think we're going to be going when it comes to technology.
Well, one of the things that I think about is how we can utilize these huge amounts of data, whether they're sitting in the cloud or elsewhere. Faircast, of course, was an example of that, mining price observations to predict where prices are going to go. But there are a lot of uses of the technology. A website that I have nothing to do with, but I absolutely love, is tripit.com. I just forwarded by email all the various confirmation and e-tickets that I get, you know, confirmations from a hotel. I can never keep track of that stuff. And it just assembles them into itineraries automatically for me. And then I go, and the website is sitting in the cloud, and I have a well-organized itinerary, and I know where I'm going, where I need to be. I can access it from my phone. It's great. So I think making use of all this data that we're now storing, both in terms of patterns and organization, is an important direction.
You said, does it for me? And I think that's a key. You can go on to Google pretty easily and get a whole lot of information, but sometimes it's hard to figure out how to use that information. It seems as though we're moving in a direction where a lot of people are trying to figure out ways to make it more useful to you.
Absolutely. To paraphrase, I mean, you know, we're drowning in data and, you know, starving for wisdom.
Do you see any signs that that's going to be something we'll be seeing more of in the future, Ed? Less just looking for information, but devices or software out there that's going to help us figure out what it means?
Well, certainly, and this is Oren's research business, not mine, but let me say that in the realm of science, this is happening across the board. Most science has been data poor for many decades, and it's suddenly becoming data rich because of the advent of sensors. Sensors can be CCD arrays and telescopes, or sensors of all sorts on the seafloor, or gene sequencing machines, and they're producing torrents of data. And the question used to be, how do you interpret the tiny shreds of data that you have to try and determine some patterns or knowledge? Now you're drowning in data, and you need automated ways to analyze that data and point you to the things that are interesting.
This stuff uses a lot of power, Ed, and you were telling us that energy consumption is going to be a computing issue going forward. Why?
Well, energy consumption is a computing issue, as you've read, the power consumption of these enormous data centers, some of which are actually built on the sites of old aluminum plants, or at least places where power is inexpensive. But it's also the case that computing and information technology has a lot to do with reducing our energy consumptions. So as an example, you hear about the smart grid, and people think of that, about transmitting enormous amounts of power more intelligently. But I like to think about the consumption side. Suppose your house was intelligent. Suppose your dishwasher ran at 3 in the morning when power was less in demand. Suppose you actually understood how much money you were saving by setting your thermostat back 2 degrees. Suppose the user interface on your thermostat made it possible to do that without having a PhD in computer science. You know, there are all sorts of examples. Suppose that intelligent navigation systems in your car actually responded not just to what congestion is now, to what congestion would be over the next 10 or 15 minutes, so that you spent less time idling in traffic.
Oren, what'd you want to add?
Yeah, I think that, again, Ed is bringing up a great point. We have a colleague, Shwetak Patel, who's worked on something that you might call energy transparency, right? If you just knew how much energy you're wasting, it's kind of like calorie transparency in foods, right? It was wrote on that slice of pizza, how much calorie you're consuming. If you knew how much power you were consuming in various things, you'd make better choices, both to save money and protect the environment. So I think a whole layer of transparency is enabled by computers. And then the next layer is some layer of intelligence. For lack of a better word, it's not human-level intelligence, but it's some intelligence on part of the device to accomplish your goals.
Then it's the way we just relate to these devices. Now we have touch screens becoming more popular, but most of us, like me, have a mouse and a keyboard sitting in front of me. Everybody remembers the Minority Report, where all Tom Cruise had to do was wave his hands around and he could make the computer work. 10, 15 years from now, Oren, do you think that we'll be relating to computers the same way?
Absolutely. And there are people working on what's called gesture recognition right now and have been for a while. So it's a question of what's the situation in which it's practical. But the bottom line is, yes, that's going to evolve, and it's going to get easier on your elbows and your wrists, which is a good thing.
We've seen Microsoft with their tablet computer that you can touch, and the Wall Street Journal just recently ran an article about an experimental television tuning device where you could wave your hands to turn the channels, and the writer, Walter Mossberg, thought that was pretty an incredible thing to see. Ed, what do you see on the horizon for other ways to control these devices?
Well, there are, you know, a lot of efforts on, for example, anticipating what your goals are. And, you know, I think these devices will become more intelligent with time. The bad news is that science fiction writers and science fiction movie producers are always some number of decades ahead of what we're doing. That's the bane of doing artificial intelligence. Again, this is Oren's area. But that, you know, kids can always go to a movie and see something cooler than you can produce. But the fact is we've made enormous strides. You know, you think about robotics, and that's been much in the news lately. But the fact is we're all comfortable with many forms of robotics. The iRobot company sold, I believe, 1 million Roomba home vacuum cleaners last year, no thanks to Consumer Reports evaluations, right? These things actually do a pretty good job from a homeowner's point of view. Your car has adaptive cruise control. That's, I guess, a form of robotics. I flew across the country last night on a plane that probably was on autopilot most of the time, and that didn't terrorize me in any way. So our user interfaces are always getting better.
And yet we had that train crash in Washington, D.C. that was somehow connected to computers. I mean, do you think it is this inexorably going toward more public acceptance? I mean, this is both your fields. What do you think about that? Or are there, do you think there is going to be some kind of a backlash at some point where the acceptance of technology, both just in terms of safety or kind of concern about the creepiness of technology, knowing so much about it, is it going to kick back?
The first point I'd like to make is that, again, often technology gets blamed, and one needs to look into it, right? What about the 10 other accidents that were human error, and what about the 20 accidents that were saved by technology? I think that, again, technology is typically neutral, right? We're not talking about producing landmines, which is clearly bad technology. Computer technology is neutral. It's how it's used. We need to have the appropriate safeguards. We need to have the appropriate rules. I think, you know, backlashes are not the appropriate way. I think people should educate themselves both on technology and on the issues, and we should have the right policies to keep inappropriate technology use in check and promote appropriate technology use. It's simple.
Ed, do you agree with that?
Certainly. And the one other thing I would add is that too much risk aversion can stifle innovation. And there's an example of this from the introduction of steam power more than a century ago. In the United States, a certain amount of risk was tolerated. And in Europe and Great Britain in particular, risk was not tolerated. And the result in the U.S. is that steam technology made very rapid advances and saw very rapid deployment in areas such as powering factories or railroad locomotives or steamboats. And the truth is that there were occasional accidents. But in the end, the United States dominated the Industrial Revolution because of being willing to take some risks. And I think you have to accept a certain level of risk if you're going to make progress. That's not an excuse for being blind to it. But it is the case that if you live your life 100% safe, it's not going to be a very exciting life, and it's not going to make much forward progress.
How about just the technical element of technological advances? Moore's Law, the increasing miniaturization advances in the technology that you guys focus on all the time, it just is increasing exponentially, it seems, every year with new options available. Is there any end in sight for that those sorts of advances? Is it ever going to either slow down or plateau, say, within our lifetimes?
Well, Moore's Law is the precise definition is a fairly narrow one. It says that transistor density is going to double every 18 months, right? And it's a long way from translating that increased transistor density into computing power that you can use and intelligence and assistance that you can use. So something that's happened in the past few years is individual processors have stopped getting faster. That doesn't mean that Moore's Law isn't still working. It just means those transistors are being used, for example, to put multiple processors on a die. And a big challenge for our field is to figure out how to use them to make the things you want to do faster and easier.
You've been doing this for a while. Is it advancing as quickly as it was, say, 5 years ago? And 10 years from now, do you think it'll be going as fast?
You know, Bill Gates says that the next 10 years are going to be better than the last 10. And I think we all believe that, or we'd find something else to do. You know, when I think about school kids worrying about what they're going to major in, my question is, what would you rather be in? What field would you rather be in than this one? It's one that completely changes the world. And the potential is greater than it ever was. So certainly, transistor density continues to increase. The exciting challenge is to figure out how to use that to make people's lives better. And Lord knows there are plenty of opportunities.
What about our place in it here in Western Washington? It's certainly a hotbed of technological innovation with all the companies, with Microsoft. It's maybe not at Silicon Valley level. But what do you think our future is here in Western Washington as in terms of leadership in this area, Oren?
I think it is a very exciting time from that point of view as well. You know, the department is great. We keep hiring terrific people, you know, very highly ranked both nationally and internationally. Google, right, has opened labs here and has hired. Microsoft's been a great influence. There's all these startups. I do some work with Madrona Venture Group, who's continuing even in these times, you know, to invest in startups and innovate. So I think that it's an incredible source of jobs, source of capital flowing to the region right at a time where we need that very much.
I can't let you guys leave without asking you a question I asked a technologist. It must have been 12 or 15 years ago. I said, what's cool that you're using, either a device or a piece of software that you have to tell everybody about because you like it so much? And at the time, the guy said, there's this search engine called Google. You should really check it out. And it certainly changed a lot of stuff in my life. With all your exposure to technology, is there one or two things that you have found particularly gee whiz about that you want to tell people about, Oren?
Well, the iPhone changed my life because my previous phone, all it could do is make calls. So that was a huge step for me. Turning the iPhone off at regular intervals also has been an improvement, right? We don't want to always be connected. And then again, this website, tripit.com, which allows me to organize and collaborate all my travel plans, has been great for me.
Ed, how about you? A piece of software or hardware?
Well, I want to continue on the theme of the phone as an Uber device, right? First of all, 98-99% of all microprocessors are in things that we don't think of as computers, right? They're in your cell phone, they're in your MP3 music player, they're in your camera, they're in all these things, your GPS in your car that make your life better. And more, these things are all finding their way into phones like the iPhone. And I think that's remarkable, you know? So by far, the vast majority of cameras in the world these days are in cell phones, and they're the vast majority of cameras that get used because that's the thing you've got with you. I was with a friend last week who bought an app for his iPhone that replaces a $450 laser rangefinder for finding how far you are from the pin on a golf course. All right, this thing.
I have a friend, a relative who works at Bose, the music, right? The audio company, and the same thing. He says he all these specialized devices he used to have, now he can just use his iPhone for that.
Pretty
amazing. We're going to have to leave it at that. We'll have to have you guys back. Ed Lazauska, computer science and engineering professor at the University of Washington, and computer science professor Oren Etzioni. He's the founder of Faircast, which is now Bing Travel. Thanks to both of you for stopping by. We appreciate it.
You bet.
Thank you.
Our program produced by David Hyde with Jason Pagano. We get production help from Andrew Walsh and Julia Rudick and Amy Rainey. Bernard Ouellette is the engineer. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.